Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Is it time to call a new epoch on planet Earth?
It's clear that dramatic changes are happening. Giving it a name is sensible. I like it.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. On today's show, no water, no wine. Some winemakers are turning to a strange tool to find H2O during a drought. Also, trash or no trash, how a well-intentioned symbol has confused our recycling ways, and what a whale's mouth can tell us about whale stress. But first up, it's the year 2016, the second decade of this millennium. We live in the information age. I'm part of Generation X. Us humans, we like to break our lives and our history into different chunks, time periods. Makes it easier to study ourselves, to talk about changes that have happened. Geologists do this too, but their chunks of time are much bigger. Eons, epochs, ages, they can last thousands or millions of years. Because of that, no modern human has been able to say that they lived to see the beginning of a new geological epoch. But all of us on this planet right now, we might get lucky like that. Well, maybe lucky isn't the right word, but geologists are debating right now whether it is time to introduce a new epoch in the Earth's 4.5 billion year history. Our science reporter Irina Zhorov is here now to tell us more. Hi, Irina.
Hi, Megan.
Now, I remember the beginning of a new millennium, New Year's Eve, 1999. That was very exciting. But this feels much bigger, like New Year's Eve in an eternity kind of setting.
Well, just to give you a little bit of context, right now the epoch we're in is the Holocene. It's been going on for 11,000 years since the last great glaciation, when glaciers covering the entire planet melted. But that's a long time. If you think about human history, the start of agriculture, right? Jesus, Cleopatra, and us, all in the same epoch. That's like the most eventful year, if you think of it that way. But actually, the Holocene is really short for geologic epochs. But a lot of scientists are saying that it has ended and a new epoch has begun.
And this new epoch, people have been throwing around the term Anthropocene. What are they talking about?
Yeah, that's right. So Anthropocene would be the epoch defined and shaped by humans. We hear a lot about human-caused climate change. It would be a recognition of that, as well as many other changes wrought by humans on the planet. And by recognizing it in the geologic record, the scientists would be saying, yes, it has caused these global changes.
So this sounds a little bit like the political discussions we've been hearing so much about, climate change. Is this about geology or politics?
Well, some people have argued that the geologists are actually reacting to popular culture. They listen to the news too, you know, and we've heard a lot about human-caused climate change. But actually, geologists, when they think about time, when they think about adding to their time scale, they're looking for something very specific. So the geologic calendar, unlike the human calendar, is correlated to something tangible, to rocks, rock formations. And when they're deciding whether to add the Anthropocene, they're going to go out and they're going to look for rocks that show that something has changed from the Holocene. And it's actually really fascinating because when they find the formation that is representative of a specific epoch and they find the border where it switched from the previous epoch, they actually drive a physical golden spike into that rock formation to mark the spot.
A literal spike.
Yeah, like an oversized pin. This is where things changed and when.
And are there lots of them?
There are fewer than 100 golden spikes around the world. The U.S. can claim about a handful, most in the middle of nowhere. But there's one in Pueblo, Colorado, at a state park. Since I'm in Philadelphia and there aren't any golden spikes around here, I called up Holly Pretzky, a reporter with KRCC, close to Pueblo, and asked her to go out to it for me, just to see what it's like.
Hello?
Hi, is this Holly?
This is.
While she waited to meet the ranger who'd show her to the site, she checked out the visitor center. Do they have anything about the golden spike in the interpretive center?
I'm not seeing anything. There's a really intense taxidermied mountain lion mauling a taxidermied deer. I see nothing about the golden spike.
Huh, so not a big draw.
I feel like it's a pretty niche audience that would be interested in the golden spike.
The ranger finally came out.
So it's a couple miles away from the visitor center, so we're going to drive there.
Okay. So while they're looking for the golden spike, I head across town to the University of Pennsylvania to talk to a geologist about how rocks help determine geologic time.
I'm Herman Pfefferkorn, professor of geology.
Pfefferkorn's office is a large, well-lit room that seems to have closed in on itself with shelves and cabinets and papers generated during his 43 years there. Scientists started thinking about rock ages in the 1600s, but the timescale didn't appear until the early 1800s.
The geologic timescale was started to begin with by engineers who discovered that the name was Smith in England. When he was building canals, he found again and again the same sequence of rocks.
Early timescales showed rock sequences in the order they formed, their ages expressed relative to other rocks. Eventually, geologists figured out how to attribute specific years to them. Today, the units in the timescale have ages, but each is still correlated to rocks somewhere, defined by their relative position to other rock sections and a marker, like a unique fossil. To an uneducated eye, rocks may not offer many clues as to their age, but Pfefferkorn has studied the stuff for a long time and has honed his ID skills into a kind of party trick.
If I look at some rock that has fossils, for about half an hour, I can tell you what the age is.
He picks up a small stone with a white fossil in it, straight like a straw with subdivisions.
Oh yeah, here, for instance, this is a limestone. It's a black limestone. It's polished. This is from Morocco.
The fossilized creature, he says, is a relative of the octopus and lived more than 440 million years ago.
These lived only in the Paleozoic. Actually, this is Ordovician. The Ordovician period. So just from this, I can tell that.
You can't do this trick with every rock. So when picking a rock bed to represent a given time period, geologists look for one with evidence of what was going on in the world then, like in Pfefferkorn's sample. Then they try to find a boundary, when the switch from one time to another happened. Some boundaries are clear, like debris from a meteor that helped bring about the extinction of the dinosaurs. Others are ultimately drawn and defined by the scientists. But once geologists accept that boundary, they drive a golden spike into the chosen spot. I tell Pfefferkorn about Holly, how she's running around looking for a golden spike for me, and he gets very excited.
You want a golden spike?
And disappears behind the shelf.
I'm looking for the best one. I have quite a number here.
He comes out holding an old railroad spike that he spray-painted gold.
I have a golden spike. Here's the golden spike.
He used to give these to geologists on field trips, doing the hard work of investigating new boundaries, the ultimate nerd souvenir. He says the idea for the geologic golden spike actually comes from the railroad. When the Eastern and Western tracks first met in May of 1869, a golden railroad spike joined them.
The image is useful because it says, here is the place, and two things come together here.
Right now, geologists are searching for a golden spike site to show the start of a new epoch, the Anthropocene. Literally translated from the Greek, anthropo means human. The word has been increasingly used to talk about our current time period, mostly in reference to human-caused climate change. In 2008, a group of scientists published a paper saying it's time geologists took up the term and figured out if it merited official recognition on their timescale. Jan Zalishevich, a geologist in England, was the lead author.
In science, if something is real, you know, if something is a distinct phenomenon, we tend to give it a name.
One thing led to another, and Zalishevich ended up heading a working group tasked with examining this question for the international community of geologists.
You need to lay out evidence that both the Earth system function has changed substantially and effectively permanently, and also that change is reflected in rocks, in strata.
Since Zalishevich started this work, he's published more papers, saying, basically, yeah, the evidence is there. Let's do this. Let's put the Anthropocene on the time scale.
So, for instance, you know, looking outside of the window now, you know, I can see roads and buildings, and I know that under those roads and buildings there is a mass of reworked ground, which likely has bits of asphalt and concrete and brick and plastic, ceramic, all that kind of thing within it.
Those things could work as markers in the strata, like fossils do in other rocks. Then there are chemical signals from pollution, radioactive traces from atomic bombs, and biological signs in the form of extinctions and redistribution of animals around the globe.
So there are a wide range of signals that reflect important kinds of global change, earth system change, which are being petrified, if you like, already, you know, into strata now forming.
Not everyone is on board with this. Lucy Edwards, a U.S. Geological Survey geologist in Virginia, recently published a paper saying the evidence isn't good enough.
But I'm kind of a wait-and-see person.
She says, yes, humans are affecting the planet, and signs of that are all around us. But she's not convinced that the geologic record clearly reflects this yet. And many geologists are with her.
I guess if you had to pin me down, I'd say I think it's premature because I can't go up and put my finger on a lot of rocks that I would call Anthropocene.
The issue is rocks take a long time to form. And the Anthropocene is, well, recent. We'll probably see our handiwork in future rocks, but those rocks don't exist yet, say critics. Knowing when the Anthropocene started is another issue. One milepost that's been thrown around is the start of the atomic age. Like a human-made meteor, the atomic bomb left its mark worldwide.
Right now, the working group is suggesting having it start at some point that would be approximately equal to 1950. That makes it a very, very short time period. And what it means is a lot of things that humans have done and humans have left as deposits would no longer be Anthropocene. A Roman road, you know, an indigenous people's campsite, and on and on and on.
Zalishevich has taken these critiques seriously. He says he gets that a lot of people don't want to separate the timescale from the rock record. That's why the Golden Spike is so important. It reconnects the idea of the Anthropocene to physical rocks. The Golden Spike in Colorado, by the way, signals the start of the Turonian Age, 94 million years ago. I catch up with Holly as she's trying to get a closer look at the spike.
Hello.
Hi, Holly.
Hi. So we're nearly at the top, and I just saw it for the first time.
Are you climbing a mountain?
It's like, we're climbing to the top of this. I wouldn't call it a mountain. What would you guys call this that we're climbing? The base of a cliff.
So you just saw it? What's it look like?
Hold on, this is like a tricky step. Okay. Wow. So it's very simple. Yeah, it looks like a pin, just sticking like 6 or 7 inches out of the rock.
Does this make you think differently about time?
Well, just the idea that like something like an age could be so exactly marked. Like, how could you find just one point? I guess that's kind of what some argue that we're going through now.
Yeah. Are you guys going to head down soon, or are you just going to hang out with the Golden Spike for a while?
It's actually really nice up here, but I think we're going to head down.
There are some binoculars at the bottom of the cliff if you want to visit Pueblo's Golden Spike, but don't want to make the climb like Holly did. Meanwhile, the keepers of the timescale, the International Union of Geological Sciences, is waiting to see potential golden spike sites for the Anthropocene. Maybe one day we'll be able to stand next to a spike marking the beginning of our own petrified human legacy. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
So geologists are looking for a rock formation to drive their golden spike into. Now let's meet endocrinologist Kathleen Hunt at Northern Arizona University. She is looking for markers of climate change in a totally different place.
It looks exactly like the hair of a horse's tail. That's really what it's most similar to. But most of the hairs are embedded in a sort of a strong, flexible substance. It almost looks like the same kind of consistency maybe as a horse's hoof.
What? Are you confused yet? All right, what she is talking about is baleen. It grows from the mouths of bowhead whales, and it's a bit like Venetian blinds instead of teeth. The baleen is bristly, made up of keratin, and it works like a giant strainer to help the whales catch food. Like a fingernail, it grows from the top and rubs off at the tip, and it contains information about the whales' lives. Researchers have used it for years to analyze what whales ate, which gives them clues about migration patterns. But then Kathleen Hunt and her colleagues found more puzzle pieces in there.
It turns out that hormones are laid down in the baleen while the baleen's growing. Reproductive hormones and stress hormones too.
For example, in whales that were sighted with calves in years before they died, a record of their pregnancy can be found in the baleen in the form of a spike in progesterone. And now Kathleen is trying to piece together the many factors that contribute to whale stress, both natural and man-made.
There's definitely some normal things that cause stress. A big one is reproduction. Females usually have an increase in stress hormone when they're pregnant. But you would expect, or I expect, that stress hormones and cortisol in particular should come down after those reproductive events and should be relatively low in a healthy female who's not pregnant and not lactating. What I'm really interested in finding out is whether we see cortisol zoom up again in non-pregnant, non-lactating animals when they encounter entanglements from fishing gear or when they run into food shortages. One thing I'm looking at is particularly, does the cortisol go up in whales that are more exposed to those kinds of human events? Another thing I'm quite interested in seeing is, do they breed less often? We can figure out how long they take between calves and if there are periods when they skip a breeding cycle, when they should have gotten pregnant and didn't.
How are whales impacted by both human activity and also by climate change?
When you look at large whales out at sea and when you follow them over many years, there's two impacts that are very obvious. One is net entanglement and the other is being struck by ships. Those are actually really large problems right now. Really, they really do affect the animals quite a bit. They're a large source of mortality. And both those problems have been increasing, especially net entanglement. However, there are also subtler problems that are unfolding gradually over a much larger time scale. Climate change is one of those. It's harder to see the impact of it, but we are starting to see animals shift their ranges quite a lot. Foraging grounds have already changed. A lot of whale populations are moving where they forage in the summers. It's harder for us to find them, in fact, because they're no longer coming to the areas that they used to come. That has made a lot of whale biologists suspect that the way climate change may affect these animals is really in changes in food availability.
So this baleen, given how difficult whales are to study, to track down, to even see at times, it seems like this baleen really offers a lot of insight into their lives.
I am tremendously excited about the baleen, and here's why. It is so hard to get even a single data point, even one sighting in several years for any individual whale. And I, in the past, have felt really lucky if I could get a single sample from an animal every 2 years, or even just to get repeated samples at all, to get two samples at all over an entire 15-year long-term study, two samples from the same animal was a coup. Suddenly, I find that baleen has these continuous hormone records. I've got baleen plates sitting in my lab, and I will pick up one sometimes. Even now, I'm still doing it. I'll pick up one, and I'll look at it, and I'll think, there's 12 years continuous data from a single animal, everything that happened to it, week by week by week by week, over years, all its calving events, every time it was stressed. Testosterone cycles, I think in males, we might be able to pick up from male baleen. It's incredibly exciting, and I think we're going to be able to learn so much more than we've really ever been able to learn before. So I'm, as you can probably hear, I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be a wonderful a research topic.
Kathleen Hunt is a researcher at Northern Arizona University, and she told me that a lot of natural history museums around the country have baleen from whales that died a long time ago, so she will analyze that baleen too, and she says she'll be able to really tell what kind of changes have happened. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. California did get some rain recently, but that was basically just a drop in a very empty bucket, given that the state has been in a drought for 5 years. This has put a lot of stress on agriculture, think avocados, almonds, wine. Everything has been affected. So with this water shortage far from over, California farmers and winemakers have started to turn to an ancient tool to find water underground. Leela Day brings us this story.
Is there 40 gallons a minute? Yes.
Mark Mondavi is a winemaker.
Is there 50 gallons a minute?
You might recognize his name from the wine aisle at the grocery store.
Is there 60?
Right now, he's walking out near his vines in Napa Valley.
Is there 70 gallons a minute?
But his focus is not on wine. He's looking for water. He's holding two thin L-shaped iron rods. They're called divining rods. And he's asking them, where's the water?
Then we have to find out, how deep do we drill? Is there water 100 feet? Is there water 200 feet? Is there water 300 feet?
Mark Mondavi searches for water underground by letting something unexplained guide him.
I think it's just something you have in your body. Some people can run a Ouija board, some people can't.
Mondavi says a lot of farmers in the valley rely on water witches.
A good 50% or more of the customers will probably use a water witch if they have the space for multiple drilling sites.
That's Gonzalo Salinas. He's one of the owners of McLean & Williams, a drilling company in Napa.
There's been cases where we go and drill a well in a property and the site has been picked by a geologist or somebody with a different type of instrumentation to locate the well site, and it turned out to be a dry hole, a dry well. Then the witcher will come over and pick another site and it turned out to be a well.
Selena says no method of finding water is guaranteed, but
on the scale of 1 to 10, water witching is probably a 7.
And it's cheaper.
A witcher can range anywhere between $500 to probably $1,000 to come over and witch a site for you to drill, where geologists, you can spend sometimes as much as the well, thousands of dollars to do a study.
Selena says he can also detect these energies underground.
20 years ago, if somebody was to call me and ask me where they can locate a witcher, I normally made the joke to look in the Yellow Pages and look under a spooky. I didn't believe on it, but over the years I started doing it myself and then I became more of a believer.
It all sounds so simple. If you feel the energy, let the sticks point you into the direction and poof, there may be water. But a hydrogeologist would recommend something a little more concrete.
Look at some of the written records by previous geotechnical engineering contractors on that area.
That's Norman Miller, a professor at UC Berkeley's Department of Geography.
Do some research with the Department of Water Resources and try to find archives of what is already known before doing anything.
Some hydrogeologists even use ground-penetrating radar to detect water underground. Miller tells me that blindly drilling for water is definitely not the best way to go. So I ask him what he thinks about the powers of dowsing.
Well, I'm an optimist, and I think that there may be things that I'm not that aware of that go beyond my perspectives and worldviews, so I'm going to stay open-minded.
Which is exactly what the dowsers recommend to find water the old-fashioned way. The magic of the divining rods and an open mind. Back on Mark Mondavi's vineyard, he pulls out a bottle of the divining rod. A new wine label of his with two dowsing rods crisscrossed on the front.
Ex aqua venum. From water comes wine.
You just have to know how to find the water.
For The Pulse, I'm Leela Day.
Leela is a reporter for KALW in San Francisco. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and on today's show, we're talking about changing environments and how we are adapting. One part of NASA's mission is to find new real estate, so to speak, in space, places for humans to eventually colonize and to spread out to. But right now, the agency is facing a serious real estate problem on this planet. The fact that their multi-billion dollar Kennedy Space Center is built so close to the water. Reporter Maddie Stone has just written a piece about this for Gizmodo titled, "The Biggest Threat to NASA is the Ocean." And I asked her to describe the Space Center's precarious location.
It's right on Cape Canaveral along Florida's eastern seaboard. So if you think of Cape Canaveral, it's this long peninsula, this sort of sandy barrier island, right sort of due east of Orlando, just north of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station and just south of a wildlife refuge. So it's in this very picturesque spot right there on the sea. You can see the ocean pretty much anywhere from the facility. And the reason for that is to launch to space safely, you have to be over the water. Rocket launches, as we know, are fiery and dramatic and also quite dangerous. And we don't want to be sending huge fireballs up into space with the potential of an explosion over communities. So back in the 1960s, the goal was really, it was getting humans to the moon. That's why Kennedy Space Center was built. But at the same time, when planners were deciding to place these two launch pads, 39A and 39B, which were the site of the Apollo launches right on the ocean, there was an awareness that these launch pads are very exposed and that future erosion of the beach, large storm events, and maybe even climate change could pose a threat in the future.
How have recent changes affected Kennedy Space Center? Talk about perhaps two recent storms, Irene, Sandy, what happened?
Sure, yeah. So Hurricane Irene in 2008 and Hurricane Sandy in 2012 are two examples of powerful storms that passed offshore. Neither was a direct hit, neither made landfall at Kennedy Space Center, but they still brought powerful waves and significant storm surge to the beach. And so following both of these storms and several other events going back even further to Hurricane Floyd in 2004, some hurricanes in the 1990s, NASA noticed really significant erosion of its coastline. So the beach would sometimes get scoured away. I think after Hurricane Sandy hit in October of 2012, there was a section of the beach right between launch pads 39A and 39B that just disappeared. About 100 feet of beach was just gone.
So what are they doing about that? Is there anything they can do?
There's a really interesting situation at Kennedy because not only is it a spaceport, but it is also part of a wildlife refuge. And so it's an important nesting site for sea turtles, for instance. And so they don't want to build a seawall because that could potentially have a negative impact on the wildlife. And so what they've been doing is actually engaging in this very low-tech but seemingly successful so far dune restoration program. And so the first real instance of this was after Hurricane Sandy in 2012. I mentioned that 100-foot section of beach that was scoured away. Well, after that happened, NASA came in, they trucked up some sand from Cape Canaveral, and they rebuilt a dune right on the edge of the beach there. And since that dune was put in, the beach has actually been replenishing itself.
What are some strategies they are thinking about in terms of just rising sea levels, not so much storms?
So rising sea levels are a really big problem, Mike. And sea levels in South Florida have risen about a foot since the early 20th century, and they're continuing to rise. And this is an existential threat to NASA. And in terms of a long-term solution, well, there isn't necessarily a long-term solution. There may come a point where some of this infrastructure has to be picked up and moved inland. We're not there yet. We hope to not be there for at least a few more decades. But NASA is starting to think about a managed retreat strategy for the future.
Now, as tough as this is for NASA, it's perhaps a bit of a lucky break for the rest of us that this agency, of all agencies, has to deal with this problem. They are very smart. They are good at solving problems, right? Are they sharing the information that they are learning? Do you get a sense that they are working with communities and spreading the knowledge?
Absolutely, absolutely. NASA, as a reporter, I love covering NASA because they are extremely transparent. I actually have to give them a lot of credit for my own investigation into it. NASA's Earth Observatory published a report on sea level rise about a year ago where they did a very detailed analysis of what the projections are for all of these different coastal centers. And that was really what got me thinking about it. And so I think, as you said, you know, it's unfortunate that they're dealing with climate change in this way. But for the rest of us, it's kind of lucky it's NASA and not somebody else.
Maddie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mikan.
Maddie Stone is a reporter for Gizmodo, and she just wrote about the climate change troubles facing Kennedy Space Center and other NASA locations. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're talking about the changing realities we're facing in our environments. Many people check air quality reports along with the weather online. They tell you about ground-level ozone or carbon monoxide in your region or your city. But there's new technology that makes it possible to personalize that information wherever you are. Think about your house, your office, your walk to work. Researchers at Colorado State University have developed a wearable air quality monitor to measure pollutants on the go. And to test it, they found some unlikely partners. Anne-Marie Awad has more.
Catherine Steger has been helping researchers work out the kinks on a new wearable air quality monitor.
It started making this really loud screeching noise.
Steger and her fellow fifth grade classmates at Rivendell Elementary in Fort Collins took turns wearing the automated microenvironmental air sampler, or AMAS, for a couple of days at a time. It's about the size of an iPhone with four black cones on the front that take in air, and it's worn right on the chest. Not only is the study testing whether or not the AMAS can stand up to the rough and tumble lives of kids, but it's also testing how much it interferes, or doesn't, with their daily lives.
And eventually, the sort of a hissing noise when it would suck in the air became sort of soothing to me, helped me go to sleep at night, and it really sort of helped me. I didn't really notice that it was there.
After wearing the AMAS for a while, they'd switch them out for a larger and clunkier air quality monitor that had to be carried in a backpack, which is actually the best one on the market. And that's the point. Dr. John Volkens, who headed up the year-long, nearly $200,000 study, needed the kids to test the AMAS against the gold standard, as he puts it. One of the goals of the AMAS is to shrink that technology to something more portable and not as hard on the back. Almost like a Fitbit for measuring air quality.
One of the reasons we're testing this technology on actual kids is we want them to go about their lives. And certainly we found, you know, a lot of things that kids will do you couldn't imagine they would do with the technology, which is great because it helps us improve the technology ultimately.
But make no mistake, these kids are not guinea pigs. They've been learning the science behind measuring air quality this whole time.
So what are our guesses? There was a 10.
17.
Casey Quinn is a PhD student who helped design the AMAS. On the last day of the study, he brought the kids together for a science lesson.
You think it's going to be worse than the last filter you put in there?
No. Oh.
27. 27 and 12.
One of them was close.
Hey, we were really close.
Quinn takes out one of the air filters and puts it into a computer. It spits out a number value based on how much air pollution is captured on the filter. Quinn would bring in filters that were already stained with pollution from all different sources to show the kids. Catherine Steger was fascinated.
I didn't really know that wood smoke could cause that much air pollution, so I'll probably be wary of that in the future.
Dr. John Volkens says the next step is to test the device with college students in Fresno, California, one of the nation's most polluted cities. That will finish up phase one of the study, which is to make sure that the device works. Phase two will be a massive study on kids in Fresno who have respiratory difficulties like asthma. Volkens says phase two will allow them to collect more detailed information than ever before on air pollution exposure among children.
We can go and tell one set of parents, your child's asthma is worse at your home and you need to intervene and make the home inside your, the air inside your home cleaner. Or we might find that some kids on their commute to school have really high air pollution exposures, and those parents might want to find a different route to get their child to school. For some parents, we may find that all of the environments are equally as polluted, and unfortunately, there's not a lot they can do besides maybe talk to their congressman.
While it's not in the cards right now, the AMAS could eventually be a consumer device. But for now, Vulcan's main concern is helping researchers better study the impacts of exposure to air pollution. Take, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency. It monitors air quality in one, maybe two places per county. If all goes as planned with the study, the agency could one day have several thousand roving monitors per county throughout the country, painting a far more detailed picture of air quality. Not only could it be a valuable tool for researchers, but that level of detail could also enable lawmakers to better address air pollution problem areas. For The Pulse, I'm Anne-Marie Awad.
Anne-Marie is a reporter with KUNC in Colorado. Here's a quick quiz for you. Your empty-to-go coffee cup, is that trash or recycling? What about a milk carton or a pizza box with cheese stuck to it? When in doubt, most of us tend to throw that stuff into the recycling bin, but that is causing some serious problems. Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America, care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Every time I buy a bottle of water, I feel this twinge of guilt. Images of trash mountains and dying sea animals are flashing through my head. But then, ta-da, there's a recycling bin. I put the empty bottle in there and I feel so much better. It's nice to think about our trash, all those precious raw materials getting put to good use once again. The reality of that situation, though, is that the recycling industry is suffering. We sent our producer, Paige Flager, to a recycling plant in Pittman, New Jersey, to see those problems firsthand, and many say those problems have their roots in a universally known symbol.
When I pictured a recycling plant, I imagined nice, clean milk cartons or plastic bottles bouncing happily down a conveyor belt towards a brand new life. There would be white walls and white floors like an Apple store. Omni Recycling Plant was not that. The plant is shielded from the elements by a giant roof that's several stories tall. The machinery looks like a game of chutes and ladders gone wrong. Sets of stairs in every direction, conveyor belts pushing around bottles, paper, cardboard, and cans. The noise is deafening, and it reeks. It reeks like hot, smelly trash. And that's because the recycling plant is, in fact, filled with garbage.
Tarps, seat cushions, car parts, mattresses, that shouldn't be coming to the anybody's facility for single stream.
Is that an office chair?
Yes, it is. And there's a computer. There you go.
I'm talking to Kevin Carducci, the manager of the plant. He's wearing a neon green t-shirt and some serious work boots that I wish I was wearing. The ground is covered in glass shards and muck. He leads me up a set of stairs into the heart of the operation. Plastic bottles are barreling down a conveyor belt to our right. He leans over the railing and points down to the floor of the plant at a pile of trash the size of a small hill.
This is all the trash, Paige, that they have cleared off of the line out of the single stream since 7 a.m. this morning. That's probably 5 or 6 tons of trash they've already pulled out of the line.
5 or 6 tons, and it was only 11 o'clock. Carducci estimates that his crew pulls 150 tons of garbage out of this stream of recyclables every single week. That's essentially the equivalent of about 18 elephants every week. And the cost?
Over $100 per ton. The cost is enormous.
So that's $15,000 a week. That cost, combined with the increasing international competition from other recycling plants and the ever-changing marketplace for recyclables, is really hurting these businesses.
Even the largest recycling hauler in the U.S. has shut down recently 25% of their recycling plants in the last few months.
That's Mitch Headland. She heads a nonprofit called Recycle Across America. They try to help people recycle correctly. She's talking about Waste Management, a company that shut down 22 of their 126 plants because they weren't making money.
In the state of California alone, which is considered one of the more progressive states when it comes to recycling, they have shut down 250 recycling plants since February.
And that number is rising. Headland says that part of the problem stems back to one particular moment. The moment when we walk up to a recycling bin and make a decision.
If you see a recycling bin that has a chasing arrow on it, and that's the only information that's on the recycling bin, that's not enough information for the consumer to know if that packaging that also has a chasing arrow can go in that bin.
That chasing arrow that she's talking about is the symbol that we see in different variations on so many items we purchase and most every recycling bin in America. That symbol, Headland says, is part of the reason that we're confused about what's trash and what's not.
The chasing arrow, I think, was established at a time when recycling was quite a bit more simple.
The 1970s, to be exact.
And I think, unfortunately, there was a lack of foresight for how recycling was going to be complex.
That lack of foresight is easy to understand when you take into account how the symbol was born.
This is Gary Anderson. I am the designer of the recycling symbol.
Anderson was a 23-year-old architecture student at the University of Southern California when he came across a poster announcing a design competition to create a logo for recycling in honor of the first Earth Day in 1970. The symbol was designed to represent paper and cardboard recycling only. But as we've figured out how to recycle a wider range of things, the symbol came to represent so much more. Paper, plastic, cardboard, reused, recycled, recyclable.
I think it's expecting an awful lot of the recycling symbol, or any other logo for that matter, to represent a myriad of concepts. It's just not what the job of logos is.
Recycling can't be summed up with one symbol anymore, and other countries are embracing a move away from simplicity and seeing a lot of success. Germany's system, for example, is really complicated. They heavily pre-sort all of their items down to the color of the glass. They launched a public education initiative to teach people how to sort properly, and now Germans are the top recyclers in the world. They recycle 65% of their waste. South Korea uses a variation on Anderson's symbol, but everything's color-coded. Orange means glass, gray means cans, and their residents actually have to pay based on the amount of waste that they have left over. Mitch Headland's nonprofit, Recycle Across America, wants to bring that type of success back to the U.S. They're working on a possible solution.
Introduce a standardized labeling system for recycling bins.
The labels are color-coded by material and have the chasing arrow symbol, along with the name of what can be recycled, a short description, and a picture of the different items. The National Park Service is trying out the labels, and so is the state of Rhode Island. If they see an improvement, other states might adopt the labels too. And that could mean a lot of relief for people like Kevin Carducci at that plant I visited in New Jersey.
What's the most ridiculous thing you've ever gotten that somebody tried to recycle?
We've had deer in the facility that, you know, obviously were dead or whatever. Somebody hunted them. The head comes up the line and we have to pull it off.
That's right. Someone in New Jersey tried to recycle a deer head. That certainly will not be included on any labels, no matter where you are in the world. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to The Pulse, and we've been talking about human impact on the environment. We make too much trash, we're polluting the air, we're changing the climate. But look, we're not all bad. Sometimes we do really cool and fun and creative things that make our environments better. For example, turning a gray and dull city tunnel into a musical adventure. Two Swedish sound artists, Max Bjurverud and Hakan Lidbo, have done just that with 5 pedestrian tunnels in Stockholm, Sweden, which can now sing. They told us about their vision for this project.
In the spring, you take a car and go out in the forest, and you, wow, this is magic. Why is that? Because of the acoustic, because of the sound. Of course, a forest is beautiful, but it's very much about the sound. If you go into a church or a place with a different acoustic, wow, this place is like magic. And that's very much because of the sound. You can touch people's emotions really deep and really fast by using sounds. What if a boring tunnel could be intelligent and comforting and listening and like a friend instead of scary and stinky and dull and, you know, just bored or forgotten for that matter, because most tunnels don't even have a name and we just want to pass through as quick as possible. But, I mean, they have great acoustics. The singing tunnels, we have 5 of them in Stockholm right now.
It's a tunnel with a microphone and 2 speakers. It recognizes the pitch of people singing and responds with a voice matching your songs. So the idea is to have like a call response kind of thing. So the idea is to make the tunnel learn a unique melody for each tunnel in each place, so the tunnel becomes unique. We can place the speakers anywhere in the tunnel and the microphone anywhere in the tunnel, because sounds take up like a space instead of a place.
We believe that if the city could be more interactive, is not only that we could decrease the feel of being lonely and scared or, you know, lost in a tunnel and replace that with something else.
We're running a program that detects the pitches that people sing, and when it detects a pitch of a certain length, we have a bank of voices that start to sing. It also has a learning process where it actually remembers all the notes that people have sung to it. In the first version we had up, The tunnel started to try to sing with you too. So you had first the actual, if you sing a tone note, it will sing back this same note. But we had that it also, after a while, started to try to sing with you and try to guess what the next note you were supposed to sing was.
People tend to sing this 5 notes in the scale and maybe do some adjustment to it. And also, again, when the tunnel is singing back, that becomes an inspiration for what you should sing. Things don't have to be the way they are. Could the city be something else?
Swedish sound artists Max Bjurverud and Hakan Lidbo talking about their singing tunnels, which they installed in Stockholm as part of the Eurovision Song Contest. Tom Henley produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhurov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, the associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. If you missed any part of this show or a previous show, just find us on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a review. It helps other people find The Pulse, too. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.